This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China. Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the U.S. presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, this is Nuala McGovern, and you're listening to the Woman's Hour podcast. Hello, welcome to the programme. Shiori Ito is with me today and she'll be in our studio. Shiori is, for many, the face of the Me Too movement in Japan. She is a young woman who took on Japan's authorities and its conservative culture after alleging that she was raped by a prominent figure in Japan. She has now directed an extraordinary documentary about her story, and we're going to hear what she hopes to achieve with its release. Also today, we'll hear about the inquiry getting underway at 11 a.m, focusing on Dawn Sturges, who died after coming into contact with the nerve agent Novichok. We're also reminiscing about the magazines that influenced us long before influencers were a thing. Do you have a vivid memory of advice, and I put that in inverted commas, that you took from a magazine? Can be good or bad ideas that you followed for your life, your work, relationships, beauty, sex? I remember trying to erase my freckles with lemon juice. It didn't work out. You can text the programme. The number is 84844. On social media, we're at BBC Woman's Hour, or you can email us through our website. For WhatsApp, you can message me or send a voice note using the number 03700 100444. Also, the woman demystifying the funeral industry. You might know her from TikTok or Instagram, Inez Capps, also coming up on Woman's Hour. But let us begin with that public inquiry into the Salisbury poisoning, which begins, as I mentioned, at 11. And it will explore the circumstances of the death of Dawn Sturges. She was a woman from Wiltshire who died 4 months after Sergei and Yulia Skripal were found unconscious on a bench. At the time, the Prime Minister, Theresa May, said that the Skripals were poisoned with military-grade nerve agent called Novichok, and that it was highly likely that Russia was responsible. That is a claim that Russia denies. Dawn Sturges died after coming into contact with that nerve agent, which had been hidden inside a perfume bottle. Well, joining me from Salisbury is BBC Wiltshire's Marie Lennon. She's one of the presenters of the BBC podcast Crime Next Door, The Salisbury Poisonings. You're very welcome to the programme, Marie. Expand for us a little bit of exactly what the inquiry is trying to do.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. Well, yes, the point of the inquiry is to examine the full circumstances leading to Dawn's death, looking at what we know, how we know it, and establishing, if possible, where responsibility lies. Now, this is an inquiry not only because the scale of the questions around Dawn's death is so vast, but also because some evidence can and will need to be heard behind closed doors. For example, witnesses who work in national security or whose testimony may relate to intelligence gathering. We will hear from the people who responded to Dawn and investigated what happened to her. So paramedics, hospital staff, local and counter-terror police, public health, chemical weapons experts and her family. This is not an inquiry into the poisoning of the Skripals, though clearly, as you've said, those incidents are connected. So that will be relevant in this.
But, you know, she died in 2018. We're now in 2024. Why has it taken so long?
Well, it has taken a long time because, the family have really fought for this. It's partly to try to get some of that information out into the public and have it cleared to be used in a public inquiry. As I've said, some of this evidence relates to national security and intelligence gathering. So having that cleared to get to this point has taken quite some time. It's also worth saying that this is still an ongoing and open investigation by counter-terror policing. And they say it's one of the most complex investigations they've ever dealt with.
And why is that?
Why is it complex?
Why is it so complex?
Well, because essentially the two incidents are linked. So we had in the March of 2018, the poisoning of a former Russian spy, Sergei Skripal, and his daughter, Yulia. It's alleged that this was carried out by GRU agents, so Russian intelligence officials who came to the city, planted this Novichok and then left again. But the circumstances of that are still very complicated. And the difficult thing with the death of Dawn Sturgis is the time lag. So Sergei and his daughter Yulia were discovered in the marsh. They recovered remarkably. Mm-hmm. They recovered and survived this. And then 4 months later, we had the discovery of Novichok in a town 7 miles away. So there are lots of questions about how that happened. There is an assumption that the would-be assassins of the Skripals had this Novichok and they discarded it. As you say, it was disguised in a perfume bottle and it was discarded somewhere in the city. It's also believed that Dawn Sturgis's partner Charlie Rowley found that bottle, but there are still lots of questions about how that was possible, how it did go undetected for 4 months somewhere in the city of Salisbury.
Tell me a little bit more about Dawn, because people might be seeing her photograph this morning on newspapers or on websites, but what was her life like?
Yeah, so Dawn was a 44-year-old woman, mum to three children. She grew up in around Salisbury Plain. It's said that she loved being at Stonehenge. She grew up in a very close community, a very close-knit family within Salisbury Plain. Her friends and family say that she was very caring. She was always the first person to help if a mate was in trouble. She was the one that was offering to help them. At the time that she died, she was in what was described as a very happy and loving relationship with Charlie Rowley. She was also getting ready to move into a new flat, having been vulnerably housed before. Friends said that before her death, she was enjoying the heat wave of that summer, was excited to see England's footballers in the World Cup. She did have some problems in her past with addiction, and her family have said that they were angry at the time this was happening with how the news media focused a lot on the problems that she had had previously, and almost making the link that those problems had contributed to mm-hmm. her coming into contact with this stuff. They are really angry about that. And I think very keen to describe within this inquiry who Dawn really was. You know, she was a 44-year-old mum of three.
Your podcast that I mentioned there as well, it has launched in the past few days, and you speak to another woman who was heavily involved in this case, Tracy Daskovich. Can you tell us a little bit more about her?
Yeah, so Professor Tracy Daskovich, she is someone who features in this podcast. She was head of public health for Wiltshire at the time. So she describes getting called into Wiltshire Police Headquarters the morning after the Skripals were taken to hospital, and very quickly understanding that this was serious. Her role in public health is to keep people healthy and safe. We saw lots of public health officials during the COVID pandemic. So she led that response, working with police to work out where the Skripals had been and where else might be contaminated, because this substance is one of the most deadly chemicals in the world. A very small amount could kill many people, and no one knew where it was. So Tracy led that response. She managed where people could and couldn't go and dealt with what was a very complex and ever-changing situation. She also worked with others to get the city reopened again after the Skripals had survived, and then was thrust right back into the situation when it became clear that more people had been poisoned. This was even more emotional for Tracy because she knew the victim, Dawn Sturgis.
I remember her very, very clearly because she was very quick-witted, and she did this dry wit without a filter. So she presented almost shy, quite a gentle, quiet person. I just really warmed her, and I remembered her from that. And that those early days, you know, those first few hours where you're talking about names, you know, and Dawn isn't an uncommon name. And then the photo comes around and you realise it's her. You know, I can absolutely, even now, I can feel how I felt. Devastating, doesn't even come close. For her family, who were private people, a very close family, all of a sudden, you know, very private, ordinary people, and their daughter's death became mercilessly public property. Yeah, it just, how do you begin to deal with that? I mean, the impact on that family is just, well, it's forever, isn't it? It's always.
And so they are trying to, I suppose, get to the next stage, Marie, with this particular inquiry. But you talk about a close-knit family, close-knit community in some ways as well. What has the impact been of this world's focus on this small area?
Yeah, Salisbury itself is a small city. It's the kind of city where everyone knows everybody, really. And this took over the city for weeks on end back in March 2018. There were huge areas people couldn't go to, a worry about how safe people were, and also a feeling that their home was being invaded by this unwelcome attention. You know, they didn't want any of this to be happening on their doorstep, and had no idea that a former Russian spy was living in a cul-de-sac on the edge of Salisbury. They really fought to get their city back and to reclaim the city for Salisbury. So the death of Dawn was devastating, you know, of course, more so than anybody for Dawn's loved ones. But also it was very hard to take for the community, who were told that they were safe. There was no risk to the public. And I think there was an understanding that this could have been a lot worse in lots of ways. This was a deadly substance that could have been anywhere. You know, it could have been handed around amongst school children. So I think that fear stayed with the community for quite some time. And I think, you know, with Dawn as well, there is a feeling that lots of the world's media really left after Sergei and Yulia Skripal. And there is a feeling that actually Dawn and her voice and her life was somehow lost in this. And it should be heard again.
You're reminding me of that time, indeed, when they just didn't know whether it might be somewhere else around the vicinity of where Dawn had been with Charlie. How long will the inquiry go on? It begins today, and let me see, about 45 minutes time.
Yeah, it begins today, and it starts in Salisbury itself at the Guildhall at the request of the family, so that it can be heard and understood by local people. It then has a break, and then it continues in London for about 5 weeks. And within that time, it will hear from lots of different people who were involved in many different ways in what happened. As I say, some of it behind closed doors. But what we will bring you in this new podcast, The Salisbury Poisonings, hearing the testimony, making sense of that testimony. And then by next year, at some point, we will get a report. We'll get a sense of what this has all been leading to.
Marie Lennon, thank you so much. Her new podcast, Crime Next Door, The Salisbury Poisonings, as you mentioned, you can find it on BBC Sounds. Thanks to all of you getting in touch with your advice that you followed. Morning, Nuala. As a pale auburn-haired teen in the early 90s, each summer I was desperate for tan skin like that of my lovely neighbour Nita. I asked her how she got so brown, and she said she used olive oil on her skin. Keen to get that same hue, I slathered myself in the oil and lay out on the lawn for a few hours, only to burn horribly. Turns out freckly redheads, sun and olive oil are not a sensible combination. Well, Becky, you can't blame the magazines for that one, but I understand what happened. There was another one. After 30 years, about 30 years ago, I read in a letter page this woman's guidance from her mother. If in doubt, go without. It has saved me from hundreds of later regretted purchases over the years. Keep them coming. Advice from the magazine that you followed to well or detriment, let me know. Sharon D. Clarke, an Olivier Award winning actress who you might know from Holby City. She played Lola Griffin there. In her career so far, she has done everything from pantomime to vocals on a song that reached number 2 in the charts. And now she's starring on stage and on screen, including in a BBC adaptation of Bernardine Evaristo's novel, Mr. Loverman. She takes the lead role of Ellis in an upcoming Channel 5 crime drama as well. Well, Sharon joined Krupa on Friday to talk about many things. Here's a snippet.
We should all be watching each other's stories and finding out that actually, if you look at stories from most cultures, they will intertwine and overlap, because the human experience is the human experience. I don't want to just sit down and watch stuff that's just about my community. Do you know what I mean? I live in my community. I know that. The world is supposed to expand, and television and film does that. It can educate you. It can elevate a situation. It can inspire people when they've seen something that they've never seen before to get them to do something that they've never done before. And it can educate, it should do that, and it should spark debate as well.
You are a trained social worker. How much does your kind of past life working in social care inform that?
I think that kind of just informs everything I do without me even thinking about it. I love people.
Yeah.
Had I not become an actor, I would have continued in social work because I love being with people. I love helping people. I'm the kind of kid that was in school and having girls coming to me in the toilet and say, I'm dying. And I'd be like, no, it's just your period. I can't believe no one's talked to you about this. My brother from another mother has a name for me, Kimberly Clark. And Kimberly Clark was like the person that you used to see on the toilet rolls and stuff in the ladies. And that's my kind of social work persona. That is a part of me that will always be a part of me and so will inform everything that I do.
The actor Sharon D. Clark there. And you can hear the full interview by going to BBC Sounds and looking for the episode of Woman's Hour from Friday, the 11th of October. Shiori Ito shocked Japan when in 2017 she went public with allegations that 2 years previously she was raped by Noriyuki Yamaguchi, who was a well-known TV journalist. He has always denied the allegations. Now Shiori is releasing a documentary film, Black Box Diaries, and it tells the story of how criminal charges against Mr. Yamaguchi were never brought and also what propelled her to pursue a civil case against him, which she won. In 2022, Japan's Supreme Court upheld the lower court's ruling that Mr. Yamaguchi had sexually assaulted Ito following an appeal by him. But Shiro Ito telling her story has come at a price. For many women, she was the face of the Me Too movement in Japan, really igniting it. But she also became a lightning rod for misogyny and victim blaming, her critics casting her as an overly naive young woman who had let her guard down. So what has changed for Shiori and for her country when it comes to how rape and sexual assault are now viewed and treated in Japan? You're very welcome to Woman's Hour. Thank you so much for coming to studio.
Thank you for having me.
So I watched your film yesterday. It is a compelling watch. I was even thinking at times, almost call it a horror film. With some of the things that you talk about going through. You switch between formal investigation as a journalist. There is a kind of intimate, confessional tone to parts of it as well. You're 35 now. I should tell our listeners this is 9 years since the alleged incident happened. But what I was really struck by is your resilience and kind of dogged determination to continue throughout this whole journey. Where does that come from?
I think after you experience sexual violence, there are so many ways to survive. And for me, was to ask questions, looking for the truth, what happened to me. So that was sort of my coping mechanism to what happened to me.
You called it Black Box Diaries. Yes. Why?
So, you know, it's this film is not focusing on what happened to me. It's focusing about what happened after. So it's a whole investigation system that failed, our legal setup, which was we had 110-year-old rape law. And so many of that what happened, what I discovered afterwards, and maybe power involved, why the arrest warrant once was issued but then disappeared. So, and when I face these things, especially police were using the term of black box. We don't know what happened in this little box. I think they were talking about, you know, like behind a closed door. But then later I learned going through investigation and, you know, facing these powers, there are so many black boxes in our community. So for me to make a film to investigate my own case was open up these black boxes one by one.
But as you're opening up these black boxes, you take us through that journey with your film because I remember your case, but I hadn't read extensively recently about it. And that's why I mentioned the horror part of it as various aspects are revealed. When you were making the film, you were filming yourself from a number of years ago, and did you have the final story in mind of what would happen? Explain how it occurred.
Well, first 2 years was purely protection reason, so I just constantly recording the conversation with police and whatever that involved with the case, because I didn't believe that they were doing the job. But then when the case didn't go anywhere, I decided to ask to reopen the case, and that was a time when I went public, which was half a year before the Me Too movement happened. So in Japan, where the society is not really used to talk about this issue, it's really often stigmatized, and there's so much, such a strong norm against victims. So I realized it's really hard for Japanese media to talk about it, and I decided maybe this is something I can do.
Did it take a lot of time to come to that decision about whether to speak publicly?
Yes and no, in a way, because I did everything I can do.
Privately.
And when it didn't go anywhere, I just realized that it's of course a failure of the police investigation, but it's a failure of our legal system. So it was a great example to use my own case to test it, what we are today, where we are today. So
your family didn't want you to go ahead with it.
They were so scared, and because they knew what kind of outcome that could happen from society, which they were right. So
can you tell?
I got many threats. There were really horrible online trolls. I couldn't work as a journalist anymore. So I actually had to move right after I went public. I was lucky that I met amazing new friend here in London who just told me, move here. I didn't know them before, but they heard about news and they just invited me, who's my producer, Hannah, for this film, and Akemi, who became like my British mother here. So they provided me a safe place to be, and that was the starting point that I could look what was happening to me in Japan from the distance.
I mean, the sense I got watching the film, and some of it is also which you've captured on film, is people on the street shouting at you, angry that you had spoken out with these rape allegations. And I can't imagine what it must be like when it's your home country, because you were battling against the police at that time. You were battling against your alleged offender, who was in a high-profile position in journalism, which is your industry.
Yeah.
And it felt like it was on all sides.
Yeah, it's hard to say. And I still remember today when I actually also published a book called Black Box, which was more focusing on investigation as a journalist. That was the time when Me Too movement broke out, October 2017. And the first email I got was from women saying how she thinks it's shameful for Japanese women to talk about it, even as a truth. So it was just shocking to see. Of course, no one wants to get violence and, you know, harassment, but somehow getting to hear from that from women was really hard. But I have to say, you know, I still get this name as the Me Too person of Japan. And I think that's wrong, because if I'm the person of Me Too, clearly it says that in Japanese Me Too movement failed, because Me Too is all about solidarity, speaking up together.
I mean, there are parts that are so incredibly moving about the people who did stand in solidarity with you. Some of your female colleagues within journalism, also a number of men that had quite a lot to lose by speaking out, particularly within Japanese society. Do you want to talk about them a little?
Yes. Well, so this film really, I wanted to highlight all these heroes around me who decided to speak up together, or who decided to be as a whistleblower, witness for the case, even that could be a huge risk for their work or, you know, where they are.
One was an investigator on the case, Investigator A, as you call him in the film. He was taken off the case then when he seemed to be have a connection with you or talking about things that weren't working on the case. The other one, which is, I mean, it brings you to tears, it will bring people who are watching to tears, was a doorman on the night of the alleged rape. Can you tell us a little about that? A doorman at the hotel, I should say.
Yes. So I knew there were a doorman, but when we received the CCTV from hotel, everything was brutal. So I didn't know that he actually witnessed to the police. And so he just emailed me a few days before the case was closing saying, I witnessed for your case, but no one called me.
And what he witnessed, do you want to tell people? I don't know how much detail you want to go in about what happened on that particular night, so I'll
yes,
leave it to you.
He clearly remembered that I was intoxicated. I couldn't get up from the taxi by myself, so I was dragged out from the taxi and how it was. And that was the part I didn't remember. So it was really important to hear from him, and he was willing to go public in any ways and telling me that he was always feeling so bad as a Japanese man that these cases were happening around him and couldn't do anything about it. So it's just that, you know, when we say Me Too, it's often coming from a victim. But I think especially a society like Japan, it has to come from bystanders and everyone around. So he was an amazing example. So I just really lucky that he stepped forward.
Yes. And with that case, which is part of your film, I mentioned the word horror a couple of times, but I found that the CCTV footage, obviously a young woman, that was you, 25 years of age at the time, hardly able to stand from what we see, and this older man lifting her almost like a rag doll into the hotel where the alleged rape took place. You believe you were drugged at the initial meeting that you had with the alleged perpetrator, and hence this video. And it kind of unfurls, I suppose, before our eyes, and then you realise these people along the way, if they speak up, maybe things can change.
You mean possible victim.
Bystanders, people like the doorman.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. It took a long time. But for me, when the criminal case didn't go anywhere, I couldn't access to any evidence or witness the police gathered. So it was again.
What did they tell you about why it didn't go any further?
They didn't give me any crystal answer. But first, I still remember when I tried to report the case first, they just told me these things happens a lot and they can't take it. And slowly I understood what that means. It's not just the number of the case, but how the law isn't set for that. So in Japan, consent doesn't really matter for this to define the rape. So it's really hard to criminalize it.
Has it changed dramatically, you think?
Yes.
Since 2015, when your rape took place?
So, legally speaking, in 2017, finally, men can report the rape case. So, before, it was only for female victims who can report the case. So, that changed. And last year, our age of consent changed from 13 years old to 15. Yes, so it's a baby step, but it changed. And also, I just talked about consent. They don't focus about consent, but you are in state of not being able to give consent. If you're intoxicated, that's also rape. So if I were to report my case today, maybe outcome was different.
And I should say, the alleged perpetrator does deny all the allegations. Do you think more people are coming forward now? Is it possible to see whether Japan views rape and sexual assault in a different way?
Yes, I'm optimistic. But, you know, after...
You're still optimistic.
Of course. I have to be. And that's why I made a film. But it is still a hard topic to speak about. So I really wish through this film, we can open up the conversation. But unfortunately, we don't have yet distribution plan yet in Japan. It's still a sensitive topic.
What are you being told?
Many things. But Japan is weird. It's not like a strong censorship, but it's more like self-censored. So they don't want to touch something. It's risky. So hopefully distribution here in UK will be a success. So they will start hearing about film and they can ignore it.
You think they cannot ignore it then? They'll have to.
They have to.
Do you think you'll go back and live in Japan?
Yes, it's where my family and all my friends are. But actually, yeah, I just always have to find where I feel safe outside Japan. And right before the release of this film, I also start living in Berlin now, mm-hmm. so that I can feel safe away from Japan. But it's just that we've been traveling with this film since our premiere in Sundance in the United States.
Yes.
And I feel like I start having all these amazing support and amazing community around the world.
That's encouraging to hear, because I felt, and you tell me, but making that film must have been so difficult. I mean, I felt I was on a roller coaster while watching it, and obviously you are the protagonist.
Yes, well, to start with, as a journalist, it was a huge struggle to put my emotion and tell my own story through film with all of it. You know, I had to be honest, and I just didn't know how I can be partial. I was thinking, should I interview Yamaguchi?
The guy really? That?
Yes, I thought about
Which
it.
Which is the man who denies all mm-hmm, the charges.
Exactly. Yeah. Because
he would never have agreed to that, do you
no,
think?
No, but I had to try, at least, because I felt like it is not fair to do one-sided story. But at some point, I just have to encourage myself. No. It's okay. It's in a film. I'm okay to talk about what I found out. And as a survivor, too, because I was always wearing the mask as a journalist. That helped me somehow to distance myself from the emotion and the horror of the trauma. So, but yes, making the film was all about facing this trauma.
Yeah, you couldn't escape from it. It's one thing to do it as a journalist. It's another thing to do it as the central character.
Yes.
How are you doing now?
After I made this film, you know, this weekend we did a UK premiere, and it feels like the story took off my shoulder. It's traveling now, and it's no longer just my own story. And it feels great. And now I can tell, if you have a trauma, make a film. It really helps you.
Shihiro Ito, so good to have you in studio. Thank you so much for making the time to come into us here. Black Box Diaries is going to be in cinemas from October 25th. And I should say, if you've been affected by anything you have heard this morning, you can find links to support organisations on our website.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China. Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the U.S. presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Now to magazines. For generations, women and girls have had them as a guide to clothes, lifestyles, relationships, and of course, sex. Before the impact of online publishing and social media were felt by the magazine industries, titles like Cosmopolitan, Woman's Own, Sugar, we could add a lot more titles here as well, they were pored over by countless women. And now there is a podcast that celebrates those beloved back issues. Every week, the hosts of the podcast, Mag Hags, real-life friends Lucy Douglas and Frankie Cookney, read a different issue of a magazine from the 70s, 80s or 90s, as well as delving into 20th century fashion. They also have the features and the lifestyle advice from those times. It's a real insight into the way we lived then and how it differs or doesn't from the way we live now. Welcome to both of you.
Hi.
Thank you so much for having us.
Now, what is the fascination with magazines? Let me start with you, Frankie.
Oh, what is the fascination with magazines? I mean, I think probably from our point of view, it definitely stems with having grown up reading magazines. You know, we're millennials, so we grew up in the 90s and reading all those titles that you just mentioned, Sugar, Bliss, Just 17, graduating to the kind of glossy mags like Marie Claire and Cosmo. So I think it's a very personal connection. But then we both went into journalism. We've both been journalists for like 10, 15 years now. And so we've kind of seen it from both sides. I think we also feel that like they're really important culturally. Like there's such a rich kind of social history in there. And that's what we wanted to get at.
You know, I just threw it out this morning. I don't know if you were listening, like people with their advice that they might have got from magazines. Here's Judy. 50 plus years ago, I read in a magazine that the French ladies splash cold water on their chest to keep their busts pert. I still to this day splash my chest after I've washed my face. What do you make of that, Lucy?
I mean, actually, in the episode that's coming out on Wednesday, we actually talk about those kind of beauty trends and specifically French beauty and the kind of the long-standing fascination that we've always had with like French women beauty and
what French women doing.
Yeah, exactly. And sharing those rituals and also that idea of like reading something in a magazine and then internalizing it. And that is, you know, the rituals that you
live by people forever. I totally remember I suppose I was about 14 or so, and one magazine I picked up, these three girls going around London on a weekend. I'm living in Ireland, obviously, at the time, kind of this spotty 12 or 13 year old, and they had flawless skin and they were wearing, you know, great stripy sweaters with leggings and eating fish and chips, but not eating the batter. And I was like, oh, maybe that's what you're supposed to do to look as great as these girls and not have teenage acne. But it kind of stayed with me then for years. And it's, I suppose we're so impressionable at that age.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, Frankie and I kind of joke about eyeshadow colours that we just won't go near because we read in a beauty editorial that like, if you've got blue eyes, that's not, you shouldn't wear that colour.
Will not stray from my colour palette.
Here's some advice that came in. Don't have a name. Advice I got from a magazine. I can't remember which magazine it was, but the best advice I've got about buying clothes is only buy it if it makes you jump up and down. Myself and my two grown daughters now follow this rule.
I love that.
I mean, that's perfect.
So if you, Frankie, for example, see some of the phrases, having it all, which funny enough was in the newspapers again this morning, you've had a having it all epiphany. I want to hear about it because it has been on the cover of many a magazine I've picked up.
Oh, I mean, and it absolutely is. Somebody in a WhatsApp group I'm in sent me an article the other day, which was sort of a comment piece about we're told we can have it all and that actually means we're doing it all. And I was going, guys, listen, you'll never believe what I found out this week. So having it all, as we talk about in the podcast, was a phrase that was coined by Helen Gurley Brown, editor of Cosmopolitan.
Well, she kind of popularised it anyway. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was the title of her 1982 book.
But the key thing is that the subtitle of her 1982 book was, remind me now, Love, Success, Sex, Money. And there is no mention of family and children in there. Mm. And I think certainly through the 90s into the 2000s and definitely now, because this is what I see all these comment pieces about, people are going, we were told we could have it all, meaning, you know, kids in a career. That's definitely what I thought it meant. Going back, reading this book, looking at, you know, what was said about it at the time, no one ever mentioned having children. So at some point, that's
a little bit easier, perhaps. Yes. And twisted, of course, with women having to pick up that baggage. I did read this morning that Superwoman is dead. So if anybody hasn't seen that headline, I've read it and I'm happy to give it to you. Lucy, you took a look at a copy of Cosmopolitan magazine, 1982. And it features quite a negative article about the pill turning 21. Were you surprised about that piece?
The thing that fascinated me most about that piece was how similar it was to a lot of the tone that a lot of the kind of complaints that women today still have with the pill. It was kind of disheartening that like 42 years later and not very much has changed. One thing that was really stark about that article is that it was written by a man.
I think as Woman's Hour was presented in its original format as well. But another aspect I saw, Frankie, with you that some of our listeners may have heard of the campaigner, Erin Pizzi, who founded the charity Refuge. She has a fascinating story and she had advice to a young man who seemed unsure about whether he wanted to settle down?
Well, I mean, that whole feature was a little bit baffling to us because, first of all, it was called Talking It Out, and the slug on the page would say Cosmo Counselling, which made us think this was something Cosmo were doing regularly at the time. And Erin Pizzey and her husband at the time, Jeff Shapiro, were the so-called counsellors in this feature. Now, I saw the name Erin Pizzey and recognised it. I knew a little bit about her work founding Chiswick Women's Aid, which is now Refuge. And I thought, what's going on here? Like, why is she counselling somebody? We'd never quite got to the bottom of what his problem was, but he'd come in, he'd been invited in to Cosmopolitan to sit down in a room with Erin and talk about why some men were choosing celibacy over being in relationships that weren't going the way they wanted. And I think what we found most interesting about that feature is just how they really didn't take any prisoners with it. It was very sort
brutal.
Esther Perel, it was not. It was very much along the lines of, oh, buck up, you'll never get a woman if you keep whinging.
Yeah, very quickly turned into a telling off, didn't it?
Yeah, which honestly I didn't not enjoy.
I'm trying to think of a modern day, you know, we hear about incels, it's a whole different topic, but I'm just trying to think of comparisons in a way of how somebody might speak to one of them. More advice coming in from our listeners. I think this was from 1977 Cosmopolitan. I was 19 years old and read a column on female masturbation and how to give yourself an orgasm. No one I knew spoke of such a thing. There were no books that I knew of. Suffice to say, one memorable Sunday morning, I followed their instructions. First orgasm, felt jubilant and have forever been grateful for that piece of information. No brainer. I see Frankie putting her hands up. In the 60s, Bunty had etiquette tips on the back page. I read that if you wanted to sneeze in a public situation, just to suck the roof off your mouth. It works, and I've passed this tip on to others all my life. We are going the gamut here.
This is amazing.
Right, one more. How to Keep Your Marriage Alive was the title of the Women's Magazine article. The advice included making an unexpected phone call to your husband and crooning, "I crave your body." I did it. Unfortunately, David was in the middle of a high-powered business meeting. He was not amused, but our marriage survived. That one from Margaret in Sussex. Oh, keep them coming. 84844. Now, there was also Honey, 1976, an article that genuinely asks a group of women what they do at the weekend. What did you learn, Lucy?
What did we learn from that? We learned about debutantes and the deb season in the just as it sort of was kind of petering out. That was it was after the royal family had stopped putting in an appearance at the Queen Charlotte's ball, but the season had sort of carried on, I think, for people that really wanted to be a part of it. And so yeah, we got a little glimpse into that kind of upper class of society. But yeah, I think overall my impression of that magazine was how kind of like optimistic it was, and how it was kind of it was obviously a stage where young women were starting to go out into the workplace and having getting used to having more opportunity than maybe their mothers did. And the magazine itself, and it was all very kind of
like, go get them.
Yeah, go get them. There's lots of...
Well, I suppose it was such a societal shift at that point, right? To try and, I suppose, new parameters or what you were supposed to do or not do. I do see another message coming in from somebody in the 70s as well. I grew up reading teen magazines in the 70s and always being told to keep a boy, you had to put his needs before yours. It was terrible indoctrination that affected me for years. Here's another one, Julie. Put the big stones in the jar. This was the advice I read 10 years ago in Miss Lexia, the women's writing magazine. It means set aside time for writing first, like putting the big stones in a jar, then fit everything else around, the fitting of the small stone, all the other tasks around your writing. Women will always put others' needs first, so this advice has helped me be firm in putting my needs first and writing! Exclamation point. That one is from Julie in Merseyside. Are they very different, the magazines then and the magazines now?
Yes, Frankie? And no. Yes and no. I think, you know, when we first went into this, we definitely thought we were going to be reading these like funny, really old fashioned headlines and sort of laughing. And there's, you know, there's definitely stuff in there, as, you know, as your listeners who've been writing in have already shown us. You know, I remember in particular, there was a headline, a cover line from a magazine from 1976, which was something like, is too much sexual liberation undermining your relationship? Obviously, you read things like that now and it's, you know, it's sort of laughable. But I think the thing we've been most struck by, isn't it, is how similar things are, actually. You know, we're reading, like, the language has really changed. Mm-hmm. There are definitely subtle shifts. Like, we have moved on in the last 50 years. It's not like social progress has been stagnant. But actually, a lot of these features, at their core, they're grappling with the same things we're grappling with now, which is, you know, being a woman, going out into the world of work, managing our friendships, managing our relationships, maybe trying to get that work-life balance. It's just, it's all framed a little bit differently. The political context is different, but actually there are so many threads that we've been able to pull and kind of relate to them now.
I suppose that the equality is not there yet.
It's not there yet.
And so that's what they're trying to figure out. Okay, here's one. When I was 14, I read in Jackie, I used to read Jackie, that boys liked girls' hands to be pale and interesting. They recommended keeping your hands above your head to keep them pale. I must have looked a right idiot with my hands up, then bringing them down just before the boy looked at me. When I grew up, I realised teenage boys were definitely not looking at my hands. Do either of you have a best piece of advice that you read from magazines?
Oh, that's a good question.
Your eyeshadow, I know you mentioned.
Yeah. That's stuck with me. I don't know if that's good advice, but it stayed with me.
I've got to say, I do still love a DIY kind of face mask, you know, maybe a bit of yogurt and honey, that kind of thing.
Do you read magazines now?
Oh, we're going to be telling on ourselves now.
Yeah, fewer now.
I mean, there are far fewer magazines to read now. And obviously, like everybody else, we get so much of our content online.
Yeah.
Although I do think it's slightly different when it's online as opposed to in your hands. But it is, of course, a time and a place which Lucy Douglas and Frankie Cookney have been exploring. New episodes of Mag Hags are released every fortnight on a Wednesday. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Now, next to a subject that many people shy away from, death. My guest is working to change that. She is funeral director Inez Capps, on a mission to challenge the taboos around death and also demystify her industry. And I realise the following conversation might be difficult for those who have recently lost a loved one. And my guest is very aware of that too, because since Inez was 19, she has been working with the deceased. She's using social media now to give her 100,000 followers a glimpse behind the scenes. So it could be anything from the care that a loved one received to tours of the hearse and the embalming suite. She runs a funeral business with her parents in the East Midlands. She joins me now. You're very welcome to the programme. I'd love to know, Inez, why you decided to go this route and share more of what happens in your industry to the public.
I think that over the period of time when I first started in the profession, that there wasn't anything that was shown about it. Some people spoke about it, but it was very rare that anybody spoke about death. It was such a, and still can be, such a taboo subject. So I just wanted to show people that behind this kind of name of funeral and conductors, that there was a human behind it, and that human can be very, very approachable.
What do you think are the biggest misconceptions that people have about death and funerals?
I think sometimes that it is scary. That's quite a misconception. It doesn't have to be scary, and the process can actually end up being something of a celebration of that person's life. So I think the misconceptions are as well that it's very male-dominated, and being a female in this profession has had its challenges. And, you know, talking now about this to lots of people, they love the fact that there is a female behind the top hat.
There were figures, this is according to the National Association of Funeral Directors, that 50% of funeral directors are women. That figure did surprise me.
Yeah, and it's gone up in the past couple of years. I would say maybe probably the past 5 years, that has definitely got a lot more, which is for me just brilliant.
What do people want to know? Because I'm sure you have so many people that are, you know, commenting, messaging you, etc. What is it that's, I suppose, most requested that they want to know more about?
Everything. There's not something that's so specific. It's everything to do with the actual funeral. What is it that, as of somebody's funeral director, what do I do? So it's actually everything to do with the funeral. They just don't know because nobody's ever opened their doors before. The funeral industry has been very, very closed off.
So some of the videos that I was watching, you give a tour of the hearse, for example. There was also one that was very moving. It was of a gentleman, I believe, whose remains had not been recovered by any family member. And you talked about what happens to those ashes and how they turn into a scatter tube. I had never seen anything like that before. But I did wonder what you would say to those who say you're indulging morbid curiosity.
Oh, wow. What a question. I think sometimes we put that on ourselves, don't we? We put that kind of barrier up ourselves and everybody kind of goes, well, no, I'm not going to talk about it. No, I'm not going to talk about that. So my question is, well, why can't we talk about it? So, yes, the morbid curiosity is there and I kind of indulge it a little bit, don't I, and show people. And some people are like, this is fantastic, thank you so much. And other people are like, I didn't really want to see that. Well, that's okay, that's, you're totally entitled to that. So yeah, maybe I am showing that little bit of a side and kind of showing people that you can have a little bit of curiosity.
Why do you think people are so uncomfortable talking about death?
I think because in generations, if you spoke about it, was it going to happen? So people used to say, no, I don't want to talk about it, because they used to think if I talk about it, perhaps it would happen. And that's very, very generational. So, you know, older generations, I'm not going to talk about it, don't want to talk about it. But then the problem that happens is if we don't talk about it, then your family are left not knowing what to do. So some people come into our care and they sit in front of me and they go, I have no idea what I'm doing.
Does that happen often, that somebody hasn't left their wishes?
Yeah, a lot of times. And it's becoming better that people are just saying their funeral wishes. I'm not talking about funeral plans or prepaying for your funeral, but just let your families know whether you want to be cremated or you'd like to have a burial or a natural burial. Just inform them of what you want, but also what you don't want.
I noticed how respectful you are towards the people that you are taking care of. You very much treat them and speak about them as a person. But I'm wondering what that job is like. How would you describe it? You know, somebody has died, their remains come to you, you have to dress them, perhaps make up to make them. I suppose you're kind of comforting the family with the job that you do too.
Yeah, there's a lot to it. There is a lot to it. But for me, when I'm caring for that person, when I'm doing the makeup and everything, I'm giving them their identity back, because sometimes it's stripped from them when they've been in the care home or the hospital. You know, they become their illness, don't they? But when they've gone, what I can then do is give them themselves back. So just spending that little bit of time. And then with that, it gives the families that comfort of knowing that they've had a really nice wash and they've had their makeup done, which they may not have done for quite some time. But the whole kind of job in itself, there's lots of aspects to it. And yes, you're caring for the person that I've been entrusted with from the family, but you have to carry the weight of these families. And sometimes I can be caring for 10 families, but every single one of those family members needs to feel like I'm only got them.
How do you do that though?
I'm not sure. I find it easy, as in a way of it comes naturally to me. I like to make each family feel just as important, and I just try and make sure that I'm constantly reminding them that they can ring us, they can call us whenever they want. But yeah, I think it's just who I am and who I've become.
Do you look at life differently considering the job that you do?
Absolutely. I try to live it to the fullest. I try and book the holidays, live life to the full, do whatever it is that makes you happy. You know, I like decorating the house for different seasons, makes my heart happy. Do it, whatever you want to do.
You've also received some unusual or memorable requests. Do you want to tell us about a couple of them?
Yeah, so I always think that a funeral should be a reflection of the person that's passed mm-hmm. away, and a reflection of who they are and the imprint that they've left on everybody's lives that knew them, because that's essentially what life is. You're leaving an imprint of yourself, aren't you, on others. And when we get requests, we always get, I want to ask you this. I go, okay, yeah, of course, ask away. Is there any chance that you could wear something different for the funeral? And I'll say, yeah, of course, what would you like me to wear? Well, he never wore anything but jeans. So would you mind not wearing your conducting attire and just popping on a pair of jeans and a jumper? Of course I will. Absolutely. My dad, he's a cyclist and a motorbike rider. So very often he will go in front of the hearse and lead the cortege out in public. And he even rode a gentleman's road bike for him. So it was actually his bike. So, you know, what a tribute for that family.
Do you feel that people are getting better at speaking about death or understanding what comes afterwards when it comes to funerals, for example? I mean, I'm Irish, which I think we have a different tradition perhaps to the UK when it comes to speaking about death.
Yeah, I do. I do. I do think you are, in my opinion, better at it because you are a lot more open. But I think as we're going along and the years are going along and the years that I've been in the industry now, I think people are more open to talk about it. And I think they want people to know what they want and what they don't want. So I think we're getting there. There's still a lot of kind of, I feel, work that could be done. But I do think it's the younger generation that are helping the older generations do that. I think teenagers and things like that, they've got a curiosity into it. So
I'm wondering, and they obviously do, because looking at the following that you have on social media, but it's kind of, it's not a morbid question with you. Have you made your plans? Do you know what you want for your funeral?
Yes.
What is it?
Whatever my family wants to do. So if they would like to cremate me and scatter my ashes, then they can do that. If they want somewhere to go so that they can remember me and bury me, then that's absolutely fine. I've got only one request, and that is that I would like a black glitter coffin.
And that can be arranged, I imagine, with the context absolutely. That you have. It's been lovely to speak to you. Thank you so much, Inez Capps, who is a female funeral director. You can find her online. I was watching some of her videos and learned quite a bit as well. And that brings us to the close of Woman's Hour today. I'm going to be joined tomorrow by acting legend Leslie Manville to hear about her new role in a very powerful adaptation of Oedipus. That is tomorrow from 10. Thanks for all your messages that have come in on advice from the magazines that you were following as teenagers. But 10 a.m. tomorrow, I'll see you same time, same place. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
Hello, I'm Amal Rajan.
And I'm Nick Robinson. And from BBC Radio 4, this is the Today Podcast.
And Nick, this is the moment to ask you what you most enjoy about spending a couple of hours in my company each week.
Well, that would be enough in itself. But the fun is to go in depth on a story with an expert guest and for you and I to try and really get what's going on.
I have CCTV on my home. I've had people rip my gates down.
Is it worth it, Andrew? Being an MP,
on no occasion did the scan that I'd had ever appear in the other hospital. So what do you enjoy most about doing?
I love the fact that we've got a really strong sense of community. And yes, I love some of our star guests too.
Frank Skinner! Way! This is where we need tinned applause.
I'm going to clap as well, just to thicken it up.
Listen and subscribe on BBC Sounds.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China. Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the US presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.